Good afternoon. Welcome to the Democracy Forum. This is the 10th program in our series this year to broadcast at this time on the third Friday of each month. We're featuring topics in Maine's participatory democracy, encouraging citizens to take an active role in government and politics. This program is a project of the League of Women Voters Down East, produced in cooperation with WERU-FM. Our conversation today is Constitutional Crisis, the Expansion of Presidential Power. We'll talk about the continuing concentration of executive power in the office of the President of the United States. What has been the historical precedent? How unusual is this moment? What is the unitary executive theory, its origins and implications, and how is it playing out in the current presidential administration? How is this landing for the people of Maine? This will be the seventh program in our series on the continuing constitutional crisis in the U.S. This show is pre-recorded on November 14th. If you have comments or questions, you can send them to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. My name is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. I'll be your host for the Democracy Forum today. Let me introduce our guests. Graham Dodds is the professor of political science at Concordia University, Montreal. Welcome, Graham.
Happy to be with you.
He's author of seminal books, a book on the unitary executive theory. We're very pleased to have you here. And then Aaron Fry is the attorney general for the state of Maine and is, you know, even now involved in a few lawsuits against the federal administration. Thank you for joining us, Aaron.
Well, thanks for having me and good to join you all.
Thanks. All right, let's get started. Graham, I'll put it to you first. Concentration of executive power in the office of the President of the United States. What has been the historical precedent and how unusual is this current moment?
Well, it's a great big topic to my mind, and I could go on at great length, but I'll try to make it short and sweet. I think most people who study U.S. political history, whether professionally or in the armchair fashion, have discerned a growth in presidential power over the years. This is a long-term phenomenon. It's not a comment on the current regime necessarily. People debate when this started and why it started. A lot of folks would say from FDR onward, there's been a growth of presidential power. Many people think it's because in times of crisis, emergency, exigent circumstances, that the rest of the governing system and the American people just tend to look to the commander-in-chief and defer to him or someday her. And in times of peace, that power that increases doesn't always go back. So all to say there's been a long-term growth in presidential power. And I think we're certainly seeing sort of the culmination of that today. But there are other factors as well. I mean, there are some presidents who are more or less inclined to push the envelope. And I think the current president is very much inclined to push more so than some of his predecessors. And, the particular manifestations that this takes as well. Is it just using unilateral directives in a way that other presidents have long used them, or are we doing something entirely new here? And I think reasonable people can disagree on that question when it comes to Mr. Trump. Some of this we've seen before, but some of it seems quite new to me.
Talk about the parts that we've seen before versus the parts that seem quite new.
Sure. I mean, look, I think almost every president wants more power. Who among us does not? But, for many times, many presidents have done sort of the regular things. They've issued executive orders. They've issued proclamations. These have been around almost since the dawn of the Republic. And, some presidents issue more than others. And they're not all created equal. Many are just symbolic, but many are for very substantive purposes. Mr. Trump has certainly issued more than his fair share of these things. His first day in office, he issued almost as many as Mr. Biden did in 4 years. If you just want to go by the numbers, Trump has been extraordinarily active in his use of executive orders and other documents as well. Again, proclamations, memoranda, that there are all sorts of different, what I call unilateral presidential directives. It's a wide genre of things. And again, some of these are normal, others rather unusual. And I think Trump's had a little bit of both.
So you mentioned FDR. I mean, he was a wartime president. Does that have an impact on the concentration of power in the executive like that?
I think it does. I tried to suggest that I think in times of war, especially in crisis more generally, the rest of the system sort of defers to the president, Congress, the courts, and I think the American people as well. In part, that's because in his role as commander in chief, he does have a lot of power, and people are sort of, I think, predisposed to step in line in exigent circumstances. So, yeah, I think that wars and crises very much contribute to the growth in presidential power. Obviously, World War II, the Cold War, the War on Terror, all these things in one way or another have acted to increase the amount of power at the disposal of whoever lives at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington, D.C.
Well, let's just do a fast sort of recap of the post-war period. You know, Truman, Eisenhower, going through the presidents of the last part of the 20th century. I mean, I wouldn't have thought of Eisenhower necessarily as being a very overreaching, powerful executive. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, you wouldn't think so. Although before he became president, some people thought that was going to come. They said, this is a former military man. He's going to bark orders and people will step to and he'll just, issue edicts and expect the people to implement them the way one would stereotypically think things would happen in the military. And in reality, he was rather more subdued. That was not his governing style. But these things come from everybody, whether they are assertive and activist or more reserved. Basically, executive orders are a convenient means towards many ends. And if you grow up to be president, no matter what you want to do, you can probably do a lot of it just by executive order.
But it's not only executive orders, right? I mean, there was the whole, post-Watergate feeling that executive power had been too concentrated through the Nixon administration. Congress took a hand in trying to dilute that power. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, very much so. So back in the 1970s, Congress had the sense that there had been a lot of abuses in the Nixon era, and they were determined to rein in what they thought was an executive that had grown beyond its bounds, that had become far too powerful. And Congress enacted a number of landmark laws in that post-Nixon era, the 1970s, to try to curtail what they thought was presidential excess. And, chief among these is, for example, the War Powers Act, saying, well, it turns out that only Congress gets to declare war. We need to remember that. And going forward, if presidents are going to act unilaterally to commit U.S. troops abroad, then they need to do this, that, and the other thing. It's almost impossible to think today of the current Congress being nearly as assertive. It's almost the polar opposite, to be perfectly honest. But there was a time when Congress would jealously defend its constitutional turf. Since then, most folks say that those post-Watergate reforms have been watered down, and perhaps we are in need of another newly assertive Congress to rein in another rather assertive and aggressive executive.
You wrote an article recently about Dick Cheney and his role in concentrating power in the 21st century. Just summarize that for us a little bit.
Yeah. So Dick Cheney, I think most people remember him as George W. Bush's vice president. Many people say the most powerful vice president in American history. And he was the architect of some of the more controversial aspects of the War on Terror. Cheney was around decades before that. He worked for the White House under Gerald Ford in the mid-70s after the assertive Congress had tried to rein in the president. And Cheney had the sense then that Congress had gone too far and it all but emasculated the presidency and that presidents just didn't have enough power to do what had to be done. And he set about trying to bring back that power to the presidency and worked decades to do it. And when George W. Bush surprisingly picked him to be his vice president, well, he had the chance to finally try to reinvigorate the president. And, by all accounts, he was very successful in that. So, yeah.
So what are the arguments for a strong executive and the arguments against a strong executive? And then I want to come back to Aaron Fry, our attorney general, and talk about how this part of the 21st century has felt among the states. But first, finish that history recap, Professor Dodds.
Well, I think everybody would contend that the president needs to do certain things. No one is arguing that the president should just be a figurehead. I suppose maybe a few people feel that way. But in reality, presidents have to do things. And the Constitution does not give them a lot of specific means towards that end. They don't have a lot of tools at their disposal. So it has become a custom that they can issue executive orders, they can do other things. And people think it's appropriate that presidents be able to do that. But over time, by most accounts, the presidency has just really grown in power, again, at the expense of Congress. And I mean, as I tell my students, America has a system where there are these three allegedly co-equal branches, as if no one matters any more than the other two. I think by most accounts today, the presidency, most people would agree, is rather more powerful than the other two. And Congress seldom chooses to assert itself, even when it seems the president is doing things that should be done by Congress, like controlling the power of the purse strings, saying we will give money for this. And then the president says, well, no, I'm going to change that. You know, back in the 1970s, this would have run the risk of impeachment, but one does not hear about that in the current climate.
We're going to talk in the next series of questions about how anxious the Supreme Court seems to be also to hand over power to the executive. But I do want to bring Aaron Fry into the conversation to talk about how this is feeling in Maine, whether the last, well, year, much less the last 6 or 7 years, have felt different in terms of how presidential authority is landing in the states.
So in the time that I've been attorney general, we had initial 2 years of Trump one, we then had President Biden, we're now in Trump two, and you could see different ways in which the president was acting and how states reacted, right? So you'd have Democratic states, Republican states acting differently depending on who was in office, usually in support of some program or, you know, some ideology. You know, a good example that might be relevant to some of what we see happening today with the president is the work by conservative states to restrict the ability for the presidential administration to interpret laws, right, to pass environmental regulation, to you know, the EPA passing environmental regulation or certain food safety standards or limiting big oil in some way, right? We've been operating in this space of, you know, the president would act and there'd be some response from one side or the other. There were usually some guardrails, though, right? So under Trump 1, you saw some guardrails from cabinet secretaries, the attorney general, who would at least moderate some of what seemed to be excessive coming from the president. And, you know, states and Congress and the courts were engaged enough so that there would be some balance evident in how the branches of government were relating with each other, how the states were engaging in the check and balance process. And we saw the same thing with Biden, by the way, right? Where you had, you know, states, you had Congress, you had parties who would weigh in to provide some guardrails on the exercise of power by the president. That seems to be completely different starting January 20th of this year, in which those guardrails that smoothed out some of the more excessive uses of executive power, they're just not there. You do not have an attorney general here in the United States who's willing to point out to the president that he is bound by the Constitution or law. You have a Congress that has abdicated its responsibility to assert its power over congressional spending or, you know, protection of independent agencies that have been set up for, say, consumer protection purposes or, you know, for protecting different parts of what citizens have expected to come from their federal government. Courts have been, you know, not the federal district or the federal circuit courts, but the Supreme Court has been seemingly, well, slow or has provided tea leaves, but not exactly clear direction on what is and is not an appropriate exercise of executive power, which leaves folks like me and my colleagues wondering how we protect against the excesses of the Trump administration. So going back to the start of this question, I think what we're seeing today in the way in which the presidential administration is acting, in the way in which we're left to respond, is we do not have, you know, those different agencies or entities who are able to provide some sort of check and balance on the president. You have a president who is very willing to engage in whatever pops into his mind, whether or not the law or Constitution permits it. And we have not seen enough of a groundswell to give the president a reason to get off this challenge to the constitutional order here in our country. So that's why we find ourselves in just a different place now, where I think as we watch what's happening at the Supreme Court level, I think as we watch how Congress reacts, we may be finding ourselves in a recalibration of these pools of power. And while I don't know that the president is necessarily exercising more power than the presidency has had before, I do think that in the absence of congressional action, in the absence of the judicial action, it's left the president to be exercising power that may not belong to him. But if nobody's going to step up and tell him that he's not allowed to do it, he gets away with that abuse of power.
Mm-hmm. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our topic today is constitutional crisis, the expansion of presidential power. Our guests this afternoon are Aaron Frey, whom you just heard, Attorney General from the state of Maine, and Graham Dodds, Professor of Political Science at Concordia University in Montreal. This program was pre-recorded on November 14th. No listener calls are being taken. I want to turn now to the role of the U.S. Supreme Court in all of this. I mean, we've talked about Congress being not as active on these matters as it might have, but we've also got the court, which is refusing to put up any resistance to this. And that brings us in to a conversation about why the Roberts Court permits this, the role of the shadow docket, as Aaron Frey just referenced, reading the tea leaves, not actually having very firm guardrails. So, Professor Dodds, talk to us about why the court is allowing this. I know you don't have any insight into their psychology, but what do you think is the operating philosophy here?
I think most people could agree that the current court is very enamored of presidential power. For one reason or another, most of the justices seem very amenable to the idea that the president has or should have a broad capacity to act, and they seem disinclined to want to limit much of what the president might do. So it's just sort of an attitudinal predisposition. In part, I have to say, this is because a number of the justices seem to be very in favor of the so-called unitary executive theory. This theory was created in the 1970s by a cadre of conservative legal theorists, one of whom, Samuel Alito, now sits on the court. So he has had a decades-long sort of relationship with this theory, and now he is in a position not just to promote it, but maybe even to lend some sort of official sanction to it. And, you know, this is a topic that the courts have sort of touched on indirectly, seldom, I think, directly considered. So its constitutional status is a bit ambiguous, but that may change in the near term. Donald Trump has, his actions have led to a number of court cases, and the Supreme Court is likely to decide some of those in its current term and maybe use those cases to say, we think this theory is fine and good, and the president should be allowed to do all sorts of things. So it's just the case that for one reason or another, several of these justices, likely a majority of them, are predisposed to favor the unitary executive theory and therefore to think that the president has a wide scope of action.
Okay, I guarantee you that 90% of our listeners have no idea what the unitary executive theory is. So maybe you could just give us the 101 on that.
That's a hard question. And the reason is that even Unitarians, they're called Unitarians, not to, malign necessarily the mainstream Protestant denomination, but even they cannot agree among themselves exactly what this theory says and what it would justify. But in its most basic form, I think the unitary executive theory says that whatever the federal government does that is in any way executive in nature, that should be ultimately controlled by the president and the president alone. He should have personal, complete control over all of that. And, you know, if you think about it, this means that everyone and everything in the vast executive branch of government is at the beck and call of the president. Millions of employees, depending how you construe the military, and dozens of major governmental institutions. So this is a radical call for even greater presidential power. And, you know, advocates of the theory say, well, this is what the founders wanted, especially Alexander Hamilton. They think that every president has at times acted in concert with this theory. And Starting in the last few decades, presidents have actively articulated this and said, this is the reason that I get to do X, Y, Z. So it is sort of the most recent manifestation of a desire among presidents to do even more and have even more power than they already have.
I mean, I can see a certain aspect of this when we think about, let's say, a CEO in the private sector, you know, running the organization and having executive control. I mean, that's what that means. Maybe I'll ask you this, Attorney General Fry, like, how is what the chief executive does in government maybe different from a chief executive might do in the private sector, and why maybe the CEO model is or is not the appropriate analogy for the chief executive?
Yeah, I mean, one of the challenges of trying to apply this CEO model is when you think about how businesses run, a CEO is going to be accountable to some board, right? So they're probably selected by the board. They are given direction as to what the parameters to act are from the board. Their contract or their actions may be affirmed or rebuked by a board of directors. So, you know, while a CEO is going to enjoy some of what the presidency enjoys when it comes to, you know, the benefit of being an individual whose voice is going to be more articulate than, say, the voice of disparate members of a board, you know, the ability to act more quickly than, say, a board might be able to act. You know, while you have some of those comparisons you can make between a CEO, the CEO model might not work because in that model, the CEO is accountable to a board or to shareholders who, by the way, may not be the same as those who might be impacted by the work of that corporation. Flipping it to compare to the presidency, you have an elected official, right? Somebody who's vested with certain powers under the Constitution, supposed to be in some ways closer to the people because of how they're elected and responsible as a steward of that office to be responsible to them. They have cabinet secretaries who you might consider to be a board. But, you know, those cabinet secretaries report to the president, not the other way around, right? And we're seeing that in sharp relief today where, you know, you have a president who is telling cabinet secretaries what to do, and in some cases even going through the cabinet secretary to direct certain actions at the agency level. You know, we see that very specifically at the Department of Justice level where, you know, the president is installing his personal defense attorneys to act as U.S. attorneys to bring indictments against political adversaries. So, you know, in that way, it's sort of hard to compare how a CEO model and, you know, the model that's been set up for U.S. executive power are corollary.
Professor Dawes, Graham, do you think that people who think about the unitary executive theory as an abstract concept envision the extent to which it's been used to politicize the civil service, the nonpartisan professional civil service, taking the Department of Justice as an example?
Excellent question. And I'm really not sure what to say. I think a lot of it will depend on Justice Alito and what he has to say about this. Unfortunately, his view matters more than mine. So we shall soon find out, I think. But yeah, if you take the theory seriously, it says that the president should be able to boss around the head of the FBI. He should be able to bully the head of the FBI, as Trump did in his first term. He should be able to tell the Attorney General of the United States, don't investigate me, investigate my opponents instead. And that's all fine and good, according to the theory. Now, many of us say, well, no, that's not fine and good. It shouldn't be that way, that it's perhaps appropriate that there are some entities within the executive branch that have some independence from the president. And if we step away from the executive branch to think of the bureaucracy more broadly, I think most people would think it's appropriate that there are some bureaucratic entities that are somewhat insulated from political pressure, whether from Congress or the president. But fans of this theory, the unitary executive theory, are loath to admit that. And I think we see a perfect example in Donald Trump saying the theory might justify him being able to tell the Federal Reserve when to lower or raise interest rates. And if he doesn't like what they're doing, to fire them at will, not for cause, but just because he feels like it. And I think that kind of rubs a lot of people the wrong way. But ultimately, what matters is whether it rubs the Supreme Court the wrong way. We'll soon find out.
Do you think, I mean, I'm asking you to suppose, but I mean, do you think that the proponents of this theory on the court now would be taking the same attitude towards the unitary executive theory and presidential power if it had been exercised with the same vigor by a Democratic president?
It's an excellent question. One of the interesting aspects of this theory, to my mind, is that it was created, invented by conservatives to help a avowedly conservative president, Ronald Reagan, roll back the legacy of the New Deal. It has been most frequently articulated and invoked by conservative presidents. Now, Democratic presidents have at times found it convenient as well, to be sure. But the politics of it, it's really something that has been supported by people on the right. But it does occur to me that if those people get their way and if the Supreme Court really sanctions, endorses, accepts this, well, what if, say, 3 years from now, we have President Bernie Sanders or AOC? What are those same voices going to think then about this incredibly powerful president able to use the apparatus of the federal government for leftist purposes? Well, it's just hypothetical, of course, but it does kind of make you think.
Well, and for political revenge, as I think we see. You had a thought on that, Aaron. I saw you shaking your head when I asked it. Go ahead.
We saw maybe in a basic way how this court was unwilling to hold different standards to the Biden administration versus the Trump administration. The universal injunction is probably the best example of that, right? Where you had universal injunctions being issued at the request of Republican attorneys general, right, who are filing suits to block the Biden administration from taking action. Universal injunctions were being issued, and you had members of the court sort of bellyaching about the appropriateness of the universal injunction, but not acting to stop their use by the federal district courts, right?
So can you just give one example for people who are not familiar with what these universal injunctions are?
I cannot for the life of me when I need to think of one for the Biden administration. I mean, certainly around certain environmental protections and regulations that were in place that Republican attorneys general were able to get stayed while the case pended. So basically, universal injunction is if the federal government is doing something or if somebody is doing something, right? Doesn't even have to be the federal government. If you go to federal court and at the beginning of a case, because these cases do years to sort of work themselves out, what'll happen is somebody might say, hey, look, we're going to be harmed at the front end. Can you stop the federal government from doing that using a universal injunction, basically a stay of activity while this case pends? And federal courts have been willing to do that, stopping the federal government from acting, you know, while the case pends. And so you had conservative justices who were complaining about the use of universal injunctions during the Biden administration where it was benefiting Republican states, but we're not stepping in to stop that from happening. It's not until, Donald Trump takes office, you have the use of the universal injunction to stop some of these activities that in some cases were clearly in violation of what the Supreme Court had already decided was the interpretation of the Constitution and the law. And it's only at that time that this court decided that it was going to make some definitive restriction on the use of these stays, right, of these universal injunctions. The reason I wanted to hop in on that is we do see a court that apparently maybe isn't thinking to the next administration or was thinking about who it was that they were benefiting or not benefiting. Of course, we're never going to know, but it's just sort of hard to understand why the court didn't take the opportunity to limit universal injunctions during the Biden administration when these universal injunctions were benefiting conservative activities, you know, like protecting the ability for fossil fuel companies to do what they were doing, for example. But now, all of a sudden, universal injunctions are a problem. If I may, I do want to add one other thing that I think ties in with what Professor Doss was just talking about. This idea of, because we've seen the Trump administration do a number of different things that have been perhaps excessive to how other presidents have acted, right? So, you know, the withholding congressionally authorized funds, right, stopping programs, unlawful conditions on federal grants, right, adding conditions that aren't inappropriate, tariffs, claiming there's an emergency when there really isn't one to really upend, you know, certain economic order that's beneficial to the United States in violation of a clear power that's invested in Congress, undermining the federal workforce, and in particular by you know, the stripping of these protections for the civil service. As I'm sure Professor Dodds has taught in his classes, there has been this talk about a fourth branch of government in the United States, which is the bureaucracy, because the, you know, the protected civil service was a way in which not only did Americans have the benefit of what it was that Congress directed for programming, the protected civil service added an insulation from political interference. It added insulation from this idea that a president could come in and just make it up as he goes, interrupting what are very important, necessary programs that put food on people's table, that protect people, you know, from having their environment destroyed, that ensure that, you know, children get health care, people get housed, et cetera. And so now that you see this administration firing federal employees, stripping civil service protections so that people do not have protections from political interference, you know, what we're seeing is just an upend of what used to be an insulation from this political interference and how federal programming is administered. And so we are seeing a very significant, and by the way, to the extent that Congress had historically, through Supreme Court, you know, case law, by the way, had been able to set up quasi-independent agencies or independent government actors that, again, insulated from political interference because our economy needed that, or, you know, certain important public services needed that, you know, consumer protections needed to have that insulation. We now see a president who is firing folks from independent agencies, and the Supreme Court is reluctant to follow its own precedent at not permitting some of these people, these independent agency heads, to be fired. So that's obviously a concern about what sort of protections are in place and how politics are now just infecting some of the most sacrosanct institutions that Americans had depended upon for the delivery of services that were promised by Congress.
Quick station break, then we're going to come back to that important point. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Graham Dodds, professor of political science at Concordia University in Montreal, and Aaron Fry, attorney general for the state of Maine. Our topic today is constitutional crisis, the expansion of presidential power. This show is pre-recorded. Send your comments or questions to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. So, Graham, one of the sort of seminal cases in this whole theory about presidential power is Humphrey's executor v. United States. And that was the one that sort of protected independent agency heads from being fired by the president. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's right. So Humphrey's executor, it's a key landmark decision that, for all I know, will be overturned in the current court's term. But for decades, it's been the law of the land. This was decided in 1935. It was a case in which the court unanimously held that President FDR had wrongly fired an official, Mr. William Humphrey, who was a holdover from the previous administration. And the court said, no, Mr. President, you can't willy-nilly fire someone for no good reason. And in beyond that, the court also recognized that some officials within the executive branch performed duties that were not altogether executive in nature. So to my mind, what the case did was limit the ability of the president to fire people who are perhaps in some sense his subordinates, and further to recognize that it's appropriate that there be people and things within the vast executive branch that are not solely at the behest of the chief executive, the president. So it's been this landmark case. It's been sort of at the root of much of the administrative state, the idea that there could be independent agencies under the nominal control of the executive branch has aided and abetted the rise of government ever since, for better or worse. And that's one of the things that the current court is looking at with some skepticism, saying, is it appropriate that the president can't fire whomever they want for whatever reason they want? Is it appropriate that some of these entities enjoy some insulation from political influence by the president or others? And it seems increasingly that they are skeptical about this. So I think it's entirely possible that this landmark decision, Humphrey's executor v. United States, 1935, will go the way of Roe v. Wade and other basic cases that had structured American life for decades.
And the president has already tried to fire a couple of these independent agency heads, right? And has threatened a few more besides that.
Oh, he's threatened a whole bunch, but he's acted on several and he's tried to act on others. And some of these are being considered by the court as we speak. Some of these were brought up in the so-called shadow docket, the emergency docket, these cases that are not part of the regular court's term where it hears arguments in the fall and then it deliberates and issues a decision in the spring, but rather quick and easy things where it renders a quick and easy verdict. And that's one way of reading the tea leaves to kind of figure out where the court might be headed. And based on the court allowing some of these firings to go through, at least for the time being, for the present, it does seem that the court is amenable to enhancing the ability of the president to fire all sorts of people for all sorts of reasons. The really controversial case to my mind, and there are a lot of these, everything from the Consumer Product Safety Commission, is the Federal Reserve. Does Donald Trump, does the president have the power to fire a governor of the Federal Reserve Board if he thinks that that individual, well, for any reason whatsoever? I think that's one place where most Americans would say it's appropriate that the Federal Reserve Board have some insulation from political pressure, not be at the beck and call of the chief executive. But I think it's for the current court to decide whether that's the case or not.
They seem to be signaling that they're ready to allow the president to do that, right?
I think in many instances, yes. I think the Federal Reserve might be a bridge too far. I think that might be where the court actually draws a line and says, you've gone pretty far and we've been with you so far, but this is it. Come on, the president can't dictate monetary policy. But it is really hard to predict this because everything is pointing in the direction of being amenable to more and more presidential power. It's hard to find much in the current court to say, no, they're prepared to say enough is enough. I think this might be that case, but I don't want to go on record as making that prediction necessarily.
Yeah, we've alluded to the fact that what the unitary executive theory means in this administration might be something different from what it might mean in a progressive or a democratic administration, which brings to mind American voters have seemed to be tending to just oust the incumbent. Like, they're mad all the time. Whoever's in is out, who's ever out is in, and it goes back and forth that way, which, if true, under this unitary executive theory, foretells a sort of a whipsaw environment in which first the FBI is prosecuting these guys, and then they're enacting retribution against those guys. You know, what does this say to you, Aaron, about the stability of our system, and how does it even complicate the ability of states to manage their own affairs in this environment?
We are losing a level of predictability. We're losing a certain comedy, right, that used to be enjoyed where you could disagree with someone, but still sort of figure out how to manage, you know, what you needed to manage for the state or for the federal government to ensure that Mainers and citizens received the benefits of government that they were promised by the Constitution. I guess in terms of where we're headed, I'm just one person, right? I don't know what the bottom of this is yet, right? Because it does feel as though we are in a time that we don't have some example to point to show when things turned around. What is unusual about this is we have a president who is very clearly and proudly using the office for his own self-benefit, right? For his own power, for his own financial benefit, to benefit his friends, whether it be, you know, economic programming that benefits billionaires like Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg or Jeff Bezos, right? Or if it's to benefit the Silk Road founder, right? The pardon power that he's using to make sure that his billionaire buddies or family members are pardoned, using the power of the DOJ to go after, you know, political adversaries like Attorney General Tish James, who held him accountable legally through the rule of law in New York, or against James Comey, ironically alleging behavior that the president engaged in tenfold when he was out of office by mismanaging very sensitive public-private documentation. This is all to get to. With a Congress that's not willing to do what Congress did back during President Nixon, right, where they actually say, whoa, 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 we have some boundaries here that a president's not allowed to cross. With a court that, as was described by Professor Dodds earlier, that is seemingly willing to use this as an opportunity to redefine the confines of what might be permissible for the president and how the president acts. And frankly, with the willingness of segments of our population to just be okay with the violations of due process that we see happening day in and day out with the way in which President Trump is allowing ICE agents or Border Patrol to, you know, violate Fourth, Fifth, Sixth Amendment rights of individuals all across our country, or the way in which people are okay with stripping funding away that feed kids, feed elderly, help provide access to basic services. Since I haven't seen what is really going to get everybody riled up yet, I don't know what the bottom is. And I worry that this does create, assuming there'll be a next term, by the way, I'm also bothered by the apparent lack of reaction to a Trump 2028 hat being photographed on the Resolute desk. There is no Trump 2028. That is a clear violation of our Constitution. And the inability for everybody to agree that that's a violation of the Constitution leaves me wondering what the next term's going to look like, because if we're okay with Trump doing this and the people around Trump getting away with this, using government power to benefit them, then yes, the next person who is elected to that office gets to do the same thing. In what are those who are disadvantaged then going to say if they were quiet right now? That's what I haven't been able to figure out. What I will say, though, is that for me, for my colleagues, for my team, we continue to use the rule of law as our touchstone. We continue to promote that following the law, all the stewards of government, right? All of those who take the oath of office to be a steward of the government that they were elected to be. We are fighting for our citizens day in and day out to make sure that what Congress promised them, what the Constitution promises them, what the rule of law promises them continues to be the touchstone, so that when we do get through this era of abuse of power by Donald Trump, we are hopefully able to redefine and reset what is acceptable for what our federal government is allowed to do when it comes to making sure that Mainers and citizens are taken care of.
I wish you'd comment also, Graham, about this whipsaw effect.
Well, I think to some extent this whipsawing going back and forth as the partisan affiliation of the presidency changes, that's to be expected, and there's a long-term history of that. A two-party system, there are going to be changes when the party in the White House changes. And, one way to see that is in executive orders. There are executive orders that are routinely reaffirmed or struck down as the partisan affiliation of the president changes. So executive orders that Bill Clinton put in, that then George W. Bush kicked out, that then, Barack Obama put in, that Donald Trump kicked out, that Joe Biden, it goes back and forth. So I think some of that's to be expected. But as the presidency becomes more powerful, those changes become more pronounced. And as some of those actions kind of ride roughshod on long-held traditions and norms and practices, they become certainly more dramatic. And I think this conversation started with a suggestion that maybe Donald Trump's interest in pursuing the unitary executive and other forms of enhanced executive power is driven by a desire to benefit himself. And I think we can all agree that Mr. Trump has a well-developed ego, certainly, and is not as restrained as presidents have used to be, and I'm putting that charitably. But in political science, we make a distinction between the president as an individual and the presidency as an institution. And I think it's important to try to keep those things different. We all have views about a particular president, but the presidency as an institution persists, hopefully, throughout time until such time as it's maybe occupied by a individual president that we might like. If you take them at their word, many advocates of the unitary executive theory, at least in the early years, said, we're not concerned about the individual president, but rather the presidency as an institution. We want individual presidents to act in such a way as to create precedents that empower the presidency such that it can be, handed forward, inherited by other presidents who will then inherit an enhanced office. That's the way in which they spoke, at least. And again, if you take them at their word, their concern was with the institution and the well-being of the constitutional order. I don't think that's chief in mind for Donald Trump. I think he is not so concerned about The institution of the presidency and passing it on in good shape. I don't think he's chiefly concerned about how the power of the presidency comports with the rest of the governance of the United States. So it's perhaps an irony that you could have a very self-seeking individual president who inherits this enhanced power of the institution. And I think there's no greater sort of case in point or way to get a handle on this than the recently deceased Dick Cheney, who did spend his career trying to enhance the power of the presidency. He genuinely believed it had been scaled back too much. But then later in his career, later in his life, he really came to detest Donald Trump. So I think it's an irony that Mr. Cheney succeeded in emboldening the presidency only to see it handed over to an individual whom he absolutely loathed.
I wanted you to get in here, Aaron, but I want to do a quick station break. So don't forget, hold that thought. You're tuned to the Democracy Forum on WERU-FM. This is Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters of Maine. Our guests this afternoon are Graham Dodds, professor of political science at Concordia University in Montreal, and Aaron Frey, attorney general for the state of Maine. This program was pre-recorded on November 14th. No listener calls are being taken. Aaron, get in there with your thought about that.
Well, Professor Dodds made an excellent point. I just wanted to highlight that, which is to the extent that former Vice President Cheney both promoted this unitary executive theory and was repulsed by how Donald Trump was acting, it's important to remember, and I hope that the Supreme Court and those who are on it, who are making decisions now that are reacting to how Donald Trump is acting, versus what might be, you know, support for the theory of how a unitary executive should act. I mean, what's entirely probable here is that if the Supreme Court ends up reacting by giving power that Trump is taking, not as somebody who is faithful to the unitary executive, but because he's acting as self-serving, you could create this temptation for the next steward of the office of president that would just take us maybe further away from what folks who are promoting a strong chief executive maybe had thought. I mean, that's just a risk that I hope folks think about as they are allowing President Trump to do what he's doing. It is what may come back to bite them if they allow themselves to make decisions based off what is not a faithful stewardship of that office. And I just want to pick up on the elections too, because two things. One, we have an elections executive order, right? Executive orders certainly provide direction for the executive branch, but they don't create new law, and brought suit along with other Democratic attorneys general to challenge the executive order that would have given the president some influence over how states would be able to conduct their elections. You know, you control the ballot box, you know, that gives you a lot of influence. And having represented the state of Maine in court, when you had folks trying to support keeping Donald Trump in office back in 2020 by suing, you know, you had Republican attorneys general suing certain states to invalidate the counting of their ballots, right? Preventing Michigan and Pennsylvania and Georgia votes from being counted to try to get a win for Donald Trump, who had clearly lost the election. The elections are the way in which people are going to express their satisfaction or dissatisfaction with what Donald Trump is doing and what his administration is doing, or how Congress is doing their job or not doing their job. And so, you know, watching what happens with how the Trump administration is able to interfere with free and fair elections is something that we should all be concerned about today, so that we make sure that when it does come time for the next election, when folks are able to register how they feel about things, that it actually does remain free and fair from the interference that Donald Trump tried to. Because let's also not forget January 6th. I know that there's been an effort by the Trump administration to change that into some celebratory friendly gathering. Law enforcement officers were assaulted. Congress was under attack. And this was all because people did not like that Donald Trump was voted out of office and they wanted to stop a constitutional process. You know, we need to commit today that whatever the election results are, they will be free and fair, right? Assuming that we don't allow interference from Donald Trump and those who attempt to prevent the counting of lawfully cast ballots, we all need to commit that we will accept the outcome, because that's what we have done for 250 years.
Yeah. You know, I can sort of see especially perhaps because of the moment that we're in, where there may be a view that democracy, as slow moving as it is, as many veto points as there are, especially in our U.S. process, it's too slow. It takes too long. It's really painful to move things along. And in a modern world where things can change at lightning speed, maybe the president needs to be more responsive and more reactive to a particular situation than the democratic process might allow with all its checks and balances. I can sort of see that. Is that sort of the rationale behind why people think this unitary executive theory is a good idea, Graham?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. It's funny because most conversations I'm in with students, with journalists, whomever, about strong presidency, it tends to come down to congressional dysfunction.
Yeah.
And not just in the current moment, but emphatically in the current moment, Congress could and should do more than it does to stand up and stop ceding its constitutional turf up Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House. You know, some people, even political scientists who I think are not altogether on the right, would say Congress is just so dysfunctional, it's unreasonable to expect it to be able to do anything. It can't get out of bed in the morning, put on its shoes, let alone do its job, let alone resist an unreserved, aggressive president. So if that's the case, then you have to look to the president to get things done. So, yeah, a lot of people do have that sense. Whether it's right or wrong, I don't know. But that's not the system we have. We have the system, and I'm in Canada, but I'm an American, so I'm saying we have this system where the president and Congress are co-equal. They're supposed to do things together. One's not supposed to roll over and play dead. And at times, Congress has gotten that message. Again, the 1970s, post-Nixon is the key example. It's just rare to find anybody in Congress today willing to say anything about the president if he or she is of that person's party. I mean, in Donald Trump's first term, there was John McCain. John McCain's been long gone. There is no one in the current Congress willing to do that, no matter what claims they might have to independence. Obviously, presidents need to be able to do things. Sometimes people are frustrated with Congress's inability to do things. But the presidency has just grown in power so much at the expense of Congress. I'm really reluctant to endorse giving the president even more power than he already has.
Well, and certainly the founders, I mean, there's a question about whether originalist constitutional theory really backs up the unitary executive. And there has been some writing by powerful originalists that the founders would be appalled to see how this is playing out. So, I mean, certainly this gives a lot of latitude to somebody in the office of presidency who is not bound by norms or the public interest, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, for years, I tell my students, presidents were bound not just by the law and the Constitution, but by practice and by sort of adherence to long traditions and norms, just the way things were done. And you get a president who does not care about that and who has no shame and is willing to push the envelope to see just how far he can go. One response to this was that Congress could have, and maybe should have, after Trump's first term, legislated some of these norms into law to say, well, we thought everybody understood this, but apparently they didn't. So now here we are. If you run for presidency, you have to divulge your taxes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Congress did not do that. It's hard to think in the current moment Congress would either. So, you know, if change is not going to come from Congress and maybe not the Supreme Court, it's unclear where it's going to come from. I suppose, you know, Attorney General Fry can speak to this, but the states certainly have a role because although my own focus in looking at the powerful presidency is on sort of national level issues, as the Attorney General has indicated, I mean, this is emphatically something that is being felt at the state level as well, not just ICE or sending National Guard into American cities, but perhaps the president seeking to instill some kind of federal control of elections, which are emphatically a state level prerogative.
Go ahead, Aaron.
Well, I mean, I would just offer two things. One, I do want to comment on what Professor Dodds was talking about is people want to see action, right? People do want to see somebody doing something. And if Congress isn't, that is inconsistent with the idea that ambition is supposed to counteract ambition in our system, right? The Constitution is a contract in which the people have allowed the government to do what it's doing because there are limitations on the government's action, which, again, it presumes that there's going to be a deliberation in the exercise of this power that has been entrusted to government by the people. And so, yes, sometimes things take time, but if it's worth it, then it takes time, you know, because the other side of that is it should also take time to unwind programs, right? It should take time to defund the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It should take time to unwind a department of government, right? Like has been done through these firings and the depletion of the civil service protections. It should take time to unwind these things that Americans have come to trust. In terms of the state's function, you know, at the founding, it was understood that, you know, because we were trying to figure out the balance between federal and state power, states were still expected to be a check on the federal government. We have typically seen it where states provide enhanced protections for their citizens' rights. So let's take, for example, in Maine, even though the Supreme Court, for the first time in its history, got rid of a substantive right, right, got rid of the right of women to make decisions over their own reproductive choices by getting rid of what they recognized 50 years ago or more than 50 years ago in Roe v. Wade, Maine could decide that those who want to exercise their reproductive choice in our state are going to have greater protections than what the federal government can have, right? That's where states have been laboratories. That's where states have been able to do more for their citizens. Now, because the federal government is actually coming into states, so as Professor Dodds mentioned, we actually literally have the President of the United States sending National Guard troops from other states into cities, right? So into Chicago, Illinois, into Portland, Oregon, into Memphis, Tennessee, into the District of Columbia, you know, where it's, you would not have thought that that would have been okay. States really have to stand up now and ensure that they don't become subsumed or overrun by the federal government or by those other states that are acquiescing to the federal government, you know, invading other states. Because, by the way, these places that the president is invading are political adversaries, right? They are democratically controlled states. They are cities that are, you know, favorable to Democrats. You have states like Texas who are allowing the president to send their National Guard troops into another state. So states really do have to stand up to make sure that it's not forgotten that at our founding, it was understood that states also have a role in ensuring that the federal government doesn't forget that it is also constricted by the Constitution in terms of what kind of power it's allowed to exercise.
Since this is a show on participatory democracy, I want to give you each a minute at the end here to talk about what's the citizen's role? Like, what can we do to participate in working out this problem? And I'll ask you first, Aaron.
Well, very directly, let me summarize. People need to be engaged. You need to pay attention to what's going on in your communities, what's going on in your state, and what's going on nationally. You need to be prepared to have your voice heard, to reach out to your members of Congress, to reach out to your state delegation, to reach out to your local, you know, elected officials to make sure they understand how you feel. And then finally, every citizen is invested with the right to vote, to have your voice heard. Every opportunity you have to make sure that you are electing the stewards of your next office, just remember, when you vote for president, you're also voting for the person who's going to choose Supreme Court justices, who's going to, you know, choose cabinet secretaries, who's going to administer the law as has been handed over by Congress. So I want to encourage people, stay tuned in, don't get discouraged, be engaged, and vote at every opportunity you have to make sure that your position is registered and you are electing the stewards of the government that is supposed to be working for you.
Thank you so much. Go ahead, Graham, sum us up here.
Well, I think the Attorney General put it quite well. Beyond encouraging people to be engaged, you know, I would encourage folks to step back from the headlines of the day, from the specifics of the latest instance of aggressive presidential action, and to think more broadly about the appropriate nature and scope of presidential power, and to think not just about the current president, but about the presidency as an institution. And if you think it's problematic for the president to do so much without Congress, even going against long-held practices, norms, and traditions, well, then you should say something about it. You should let your two senators and your one member of the House of Representatives know exactly how you feel.
That's our show for today. Thank you to our guest this afternoon, Graham Dodds, Professor of Political Science, Concordia University, Montreal, and Aaron Fry, Attorney General, State of Maine. You've been listening to the Democracy Forum. If you have a comment about this show, send it to news@weru.org. Please put Democracy Forum in the subject line. The League's website is lwvme.org for more information about this topic or to learn about other shows in the series.